Welcome back to Bond Brothers. I am JT Johnson, and as always, I'm joined by my brother Jason. How you doing?
Doing great, brother. How are you?
Doing all right. Well, as you know, Jason, last week we introduced Roger Moore and a new era for the Bond series with Live and Let Die.
Yep.
This week we take a look at Moore's next two Bond films. Now, our main behind-the-scenes story is actually going to take place between the two movies we're going to discuss tonight. So I'm just going to go ahead, jump back to 1974 with the release of Moore's second 007 adventure, only a year after Live and Let Die. This would be the last time that the next film would come the following year after the previous movie. And that movie is The Man with the Golden Gun. The director is Guy Hamilton with his fourth and last Bond film. The writers are Richard Maybaum and Tom Mankiewicz. This would be Mankiewicz's last credited Bond film. He would do some script doctoring in the future, but this was his last one where he actually got a credit. The music is by John Barry, of course, the famous composer who's in mo did a lot of these earlier films. And the theme is by Lulu, and it's fine. It's okay. It's not one of the more memorable Bond themes, but it's not the worst. It's not Madonna. We'll get to that later. Anywho, the cast, of course, includes Roger Moore as James Bond, Christopher Lee as Francisco Scaramanga, Britt Eklund as Mary Goodnight, Maude Adams as Andrea Anders, Hervé Villegas as Nick Nack, Clifton James returning as J.W. Pepper, Soon Tycho as Lieutenant Hip, and then of course our returning favorites Bernard Lee, Lois Maxwell, and Desmond Llewellyn as M, Moneypenny, and Q. Moore's second film is often ranked pretty low on most people's Bond rankings. The film underperformed at the box office, and critics at the time also thought it was a, shall we say, tired movie. In my opinion, I think the movie is looked upon a little too harshly. Though I must admit that it also ranks pretty low on my own list. The movie sees Bond being pulled off of a mission due to a bullet with his number on it, literally, being mailed to headquarters. It is suggested that Bond has become the target of the mysterious assassin known as Francisco Scaramanga. Bond suggests that if he is able to get to Scaramanga first, then he can get back to his real mission, which is trying to locate a scientist who has a device that can end Britain's energy crisis. What follows is a cat and mouse game between Bond and Scaramanga. Along the way, Bond teams up with a field agent named Barry Goodnight, and this is one of my biggest problems. Britt Eklund plays Goodnight, and while it is cool that this is finally a Bond girl that's actually part of the team from the same company, she's a complete dumbass who can't seem to do anything right. Instead, her character is more of an annoyance to Bond, rather than a valid ally. And she ultimately becomes just another damsel in distress for Bond to save. Maude Adams, on the other hand, plays Scaramanga's tragic love interest, Andrea Anders, and she is far more engaging and interesting to watch. Sadly, she is not in the film very long. We all know what happens to most secondary Bond girls. The other problem with this movie is its shift in tone. Sometimes it wants to be as serious as a Sean Connery movie. And other times it wants to play things for laughs. In fact, one of the movie's best stunts involving a car jumping over a broken bridge is utterly ruined by the inclusion of a goddamn slide whistle. When it goes over the bridge, you hear whoop, and it's like, really? Did th that just happen? They used computers to calculate this fucking stunt. And they put a slide whistle special effect on it. Other than that, I must admit that there are things that I do like. Some great action sequences. Moore is still strong as Bond. And then there's Hervé Villechaize and Christopher Lee as Nick Nack and Scaramanga. Villechaize is another great henchman, both loyal to his master, but with the unique storyline that he will inherit Scaramanga's fortune should Nick Nack be able to find someone who can best Scaramanga. That makes sure that that's an insurance that Scaramanga knows what Nick Nack will try to pick someone that will actually try to kill him. In the novel, Scaramanga is more of a thug. While Lee makes the character more of an interesting villain in the film by making him a counterpart to Bond. He is well-traveled, sophisticated, and even charming to a certain point. The only difference between him and Bond is that Scaramanga is a ruthless assassin that's in it for the money instead of doing it for his country. So, yes, the movie is a weaker film in the series, but I must admit that I do enjoy it, even if it mostly is because of the chemistry between Lee and Moore, and less about the energy crisis angle. The energy crisis storyline is forgettable and stupid. It's more of a MacGuffin to get these two to duel at the end, basically. Mm-hmm. With that said, Jason, what did you think of The Man with the Golden Gun?
Well, first of all, let me say, of the two movies this week, I did not get to watch this one again. Now, I have seen the film, and I watched them all about, I don't know, well, almost all of them, about a year ago or so, a little more. So I do remember it. It's not exactly not fresh on my mind, but I will say this much. I remember not liking this one as much. I agree with the critics. It was a little tired. It's there. It's a Bond film. And I'm going to get more into the reason why I think this film doesn't work when we talk about the next film on this episode. Because there's a key element that happened on the next film in the writing that really shows why this film to me didn't work. I'll give it a 6 out of 10 bullets with my name written on them.
There you go. I think my biggest problem with this movie is that it suffers also from an identity crisis.
Yeah.
There's a point in the movie where he's at a Hong Kong fighting school.
Yeah.
In the Philippines, which I don't get. But anyway. And it seems like it wants to be a Hong Kong action film at certain points, which were big at the time. Kind of like how Live and Let Die, the black exploitation films, were big at the time.
Right, right.
So I think like it maybe like I could see the nucleus starting. It's like, what's popular? Hong Kong action films. Another problem was that they brought back J.W. Pepper as a character, and he's not needed in this movie. You can tell he was brought back just because he was popular at the time in Live and Let Die.
Right.
I do. Like, there's one point where he's on vacation with his wife. It's how they explain he's part of the movie this time. And she picks up this, like, carved wooden elephant, and he says, "Maybell, you know we're Democrats." And I'm like, you would not be a Democrat in today's
world. No, not at all.
You're a damn Dixie Democrat.
Yeah, I was fixing to say, J.W. Pepper's a Dixiecrat if he is anything. So, old school.
And then, like, I think another thing that just hinders this movie is Britt Eklund is one of the worst Bond girls as Mary Goodnight. It's cool. At first, it's like, oh, hey, he's going to be with a Bond girl that's like on the team, able to do stuff. And then she fucks up every step of the way. And she's just she's the stereotypical dumb blonde.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work for me. And so, yeah, it's a very uneven movie. Again, I ultimately like it. Really thanks to Christopher Lee. Just a fun fact about him. He was a cousin of Ian Fleming's. The Bond author.
Yeah.
They both served in British intelligence. Christopher Lee used to have people say, "What did you do in British intelligence?" And Christopher Lee used to quip, "Can you keep a secret?" And they would say, "Yeah." And he'd go, "So can I." And he'd just walk away when people would bring out that part of him, of his life. Hervé, people will know that name. I forget what his character name was in Fantasy Island.
Tattoo. Yeah. I used to watch this show every time it aired with mom and dad before you were even born.
That came after this, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
this is where he kind of got famous and then they hired him.
Yeah, and they hired him for that. Yeah. Okay. Boss, Deep Blaine. Yeah.
Deep Blaine. Yeah. And I love this one. Knick-knack, hot sauce. Yes, master.
Yeah.
There's a point there, and I love. Yeah, there's.
I will say he is a highlight of this film.
He is. There's a point in the movie where Bond is on the island, and he. This is where we learn the knick-knack, his true motives, which is, if you get him, I get everything. Go through here.
Yeah.
Like, it starts to guide him through. But he likes his boss, because when Bond kills his boss, knick-knack tries to kill him.
Yep.
So he ultimately does what he's supposed to do. Yes, of course, I'll get to my rating of the movie, where it falls in my rankings at the end of the episode.
Right.
I think that there's really not much more to say about the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's
kind of basic.
Basically, the villain and his henchmen were the highlight of this film. And and I agree with you wholeheartedly that Britt Eklund was just not a, and I don't think it's through any fault of her own on my end. It's through the writing where they, like you say, you know, you have to be a pretty elite person who's done some crazy shit to be selected for the British Secret Service program, and especially this secret arm of the British Secret Service program. And yeah, she's a total dumbass. And you're like, well, how in the fuck did she even get there in the first place? You know,
though, I do love that this does present a theme, particularly through the Roger Moore Bond films, where they want to have their cake and eat it too. And what I mean by that is, at times, he's James Bond, world famous spy.
Yeah.
And then when they need him to be a spy, he can be a spy. If they know who the fuck James Bond is, he is not going to be a good spy.
Yeah.
But the characters will have selective memories in some of these movies, and I can't wait to get to that, because that's part of the charm of the Roger Moore movies. It's the Bond who knows everything.
Right.
That's another thing. In the briefing of this one, they ask him, what do you know about this mysterious guy named Francisco Scaramanga? He's like, born in the Philippines in 19 blah, blah, blah. Went to the wars and the blah, blah, blah. And he gives all these fucking facts. I'm like, this guy is very fucking mysterious.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and he suffers from and he gives a scientific name, and they're like, a what? A third nipple, sir. Because at one point he uses that to disguise himself, because supposedly no one knows who Scaramanga is. And so Bond decides to pose as Scaramanga during one part of the movie. But anyway, we'll get to ranking this movie, of course, with our second movie. But we have come to the middle part of the episode where we now have our big behind-the-scenes story, and that revolves around one of the main Bond producers, Harry Saltzman.
Yeah.
As everyone knows up to this point, Harry Saltzman and Albert R. Cubby Broccoli produced the Bond films up to this point. And so how did the Man with the Golden Gun end up being Saltzman's last Bond movie? Well, Broccoli was more concerned with just the series. He was focused on Bond. Saltzman, not so much. Saltzman wanted to branch out, do other things. And he hit financial difficulties by the time The Golden Gun was released. He had made many deals that had fallen through. Some were failed films, but there was others, such as an extensive hostile takeover of the Technicolor Motion Picture Corporation. Mm-hmm. And a hefty loan from the Union Bank of Switzerland. This put him in a terrible situation where he owed a lot of money to a lot of people. I don't want to get lost in the weeds on all that. I read up on it. It's there's some fun details in there, but mostly it's he owes a lot of people this fucking money. This, however, led to friction between him and Cubby. So why did Saltzman ultimately sell his, why didn't Saltzman ultimately sell his half of the Bond rights to Broccoli? They were mostly at odds because Saltzman wanted to use funds from their company, Danjack, that owns the rights to the Bond films, to cover his professional and personal losses, and Cubby wouldn't sign off on it. And this put them in severe disagreement, but it also put the funds in a deadlock state. So future Bond films couldn't move forward until Saltzman decided what he was going to do, because Cubby wasn't budging. This actually caused a potentially bigger problem, because it was stated in their initial deal with United Artists that if they didn't get a Bond film going within 18 months, they ran the risk of losing all of their rights to UA. Saltzman ultimately agreed to sell his half of the rights to United Artists for two reasons, both so that a new movie could move forward and to spite Cubby, who would now have to work with UA in order to get another Bond movie made. Of course, Cubby was initially against the idea. He wanted all the rights, understandably so. However, Saltzman countered him and said, well, I've also got a rival company called Columbia Pictures that is offering me a deal. And so if you don't accept this deal with UA, I'm going to them. And ultimately, Cubby relented and Saltzman sold his rights to UA for what ended up being 20 million pounds.
Yeah.
After these legal troubles, and 3 years after the release of The Man with the Golden Gun, this was the longest gap between Bond films at the time, we were finally going to get the 10th James Bond adventure. Turns out Cubby was able to work extremely well with United Artists because they wanted him to continue as the producer of the series. They wanted him in charge. They didn't want him going anywhere.
Right.
The only thing was that after the poor reception of the previous movie and due to the larger than usual gap between films, Cubby also knew he had to go big or go home.
Right.
So, for example, production designer Ken Adams comes to him with the with this set for this huge oil tanker that can hold three fucking submarines, full-size submarine replicas. And he tells Broccoli, I don't have a studio in the world that could hold this set that I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
So Broccoli just simply looked at him, this is according to Adam, simply looked at him and said, then we'll build it.
Yeah.
And so they go to Pinewood Studios and they build the biggest studio in the world at the time, at least. And it's actually christened the 007 stage.
Right.
This stage would go on to serve many, many films, not just the Bond movies. The production from there on went pretty smoothly. There were some complications, I think, when they were in Egypt, shooting that part of the film where like they didn't have food trucks.
Yeah. And so it was a very simple thing happened. They sent food forward, so that they could prepare meals and stuff. Somebody, and this is no bullshit, forgot to plug in the freezer. And so everything had rotted by the time they got there. It's a very cool story to it, too, about how Broccoli ended up cooking for them.
And Cubby, the man himself, they emptied out the trucks, and then they set up a thing where he shipped in a bunch of spaghetti. And he was able to make him make everybody spaghetti and meatballs and stuff like that so they could eat. That was like probably one of the biggest things they went through. But beyond that, the new movie was made. The new movie was finally released on July 8th, 1977 in the United Kingdom. And it was seen largely as a return to form for the series.
Yes.
So now it's time for us to take a look at that film. And the film is The Spy Who Loved Me. It's from director Lewis Gilbert. This is his second Bond film after You Only Live Twice. It's from writers Christopher Wood and Richard Maybaum. The music is from Marvin Hamlisch, and that's probably my weakest part of this movie, is the score.
Because
it's very much of its time.
Yeah, but I will say the collaboration, and I'll get to this later when I talk about my little extra thing, but the collaboration with him and Carly Simon for the theme.
And I was about to say, flip side of that score is Carly Simon with Nobody Does It Better.
Yes.
I love that theme. This film, of course, features more. It features Barbara Bach as Anya Amasova. Anyone who's a fan of Ringo Starr will understand that that's his wife. Lucky bastard.
Yes.
Kurt Jurgens as Carl Stromberg. Richard Kiel as Jaws. Carolyn Monroe as Naomi. Walter Gotell, who played a villain in From Russia With Love, returns for the first time in this as General Gogol. And then, of course, Bernard Lee, Lois Maxwell, and Desmond Llewellyn returning as usual.
Yeah.
A lot was hanging in the balance for The Spy Who Loved Me. It had to be a hit, or the Bond series could have very well have ended here. The movie brought back Gilbert, as I mentioned before. he had done the more fantastical You Only Live Twice from before. But this film still manages, even though it's a bigger film even than that one, it still doesn't manage to feel as over the top as You Only Live Twice. The movie sees Bond trying to track down the maniacal plot of Carl Stromberg, a dictator wannabe who wants to create a new civilization under the sea after wiping out most of the life on the surface. At the same time, Bond finds himself working with Anya Amosova, a Russian spy known as Triple X. I wonder what kind of entendre that is.
Yeah.
She's trying to stop Stromberg as well. And eventually both General Gogol and M are like, oh, they'll work well together. So they end up on this adventure together. The movie is a spectacle, and it also happens to be one of Moore's best Bond films. In fact, for a while, I used to say this was my favorite of all of Roger Moore's films. That's changed a little bit, but the reason it's one of his best films is the action is fun. Moore was never more comfortable as 007 than he was in this movie. Bach is a great Bond girl, the exact opposite of Britt Eklund as Mary Goodnight. The only real problem is that Stromberg is not one of the stronger Bond villains. He services the plot, but his world-conquering plot line and him are kind of, it's kind of the same. We've been there, done that.
Kind of the same, but I'll get into more why I like this whenever you flip over.
The greater villain in the movie, the more memorable villain, I should say, is, of course, Stromberg's henchman, Jaws.
Yes.
A character who kills it with his large metal teeth. Doesn't help that Jaws' presence is also helped by Richard Kiel's commanding 7'2" presence. A tall motherfucker. He has a few memorable run-ins with Bond and understandably became a breakout character. At the end of the day, the James Bond adventure did what it was supposed to do. It was a thrilling ride. It single-handedly revived a film series that was on the brink of ending for good. Jason, you told me earlier you were watching this film, so I know you've watched this
one. Oh, yeah, it's fresh.
What were your thoughts on The Spy Who Loved Me?
Honestly, okay, I got to say something first. To me, there is, it's kind of like Coke Classic and New Coke. There is a classic Bond. There is Daniel Craig Bond. Okay, there's a division there because I'm going to say something about this film and then I'm going to quantify it because of that. It is in the top three of my classic Bond films. And I say that because if I did a top three of all the Bond films together, I would have to have Goldfinger number one, and then the next two would be throw a dart at any of the Craig films, and that'll be the fucking two that go in there. Because I love the Daniel Craig films so much. But yeah, if I'm ranking just the classic Bonds, this is literally in my top three. I love this movie, and for several reasons. Number one, you mentioned Barbara Bach. She is one of probably the most beautiful Bond girls there's ever been, but also what caps it off is very capable, even outwits Bond. Second thing is not so much the villain, the head guy there, because I did think he was a little weak, but it was his motivations. Bond even asked him at one point, okay, how much money to stop this? And you find out, no, I'm the richest man in the fucking world. I don't need money. He has a not only want for power to be in charge of the entire post-apocalyptic world, but also a savior complex. I'm going to save it. And if you look, this film fits in well today because if you look at these fucking billionaires that are running around, they all have a power and a savior complex. Of course, not to the villainy of this, but
Jason,
you know, I'm going to say.
Talking about?
Well, not
I don't
even
know
him.
Who you're talking about.
Not even him. It's Elon fucking Musk is who we're talking about. The dude thinks he's. He has said, "I'm going to save the world with what I'm doing with these companies." He's literally said it.
He is a real Carl Stromberg.
He kind of is, you know. So there's that. There's the Bond girl, the villain. Okay, coupled with the villain, we have the henchman that was so good in his role. They had to rewrite his ending to keep him alive because they knew they were going to bring him back.
Supposed to die, yeah. Yep.
And then in the, coupled again with the villain, we get our secret lair that is literally no bullshit. The fucking secret lair of the Legion of Doom in the Super Friends. Jesus Christ. What more can you give me? Okay, so those are the fun little side notes. The one of the main things that makes this a great movie, and it is the writers were told, so far we've kind of written these first couple of more films with Connery's Bond in mind. Now we want you to write Bond the way Bond is in the books. He is, and I quote, very British, very smooth, and has a good sense of humor. And Roger Moore, with that script, plays it to a T. He's perfect as this Bond. Also, first time on television, or I mean on a screen anywhere, the birth of the jet ski.
I had some facts here I was going to give. One was the jet ski.
The other thing I want to mention too. The other thing I want to mention too, real quick, is I did like the we were going through a period in that time of the Soviet Union and the U.S. and England and all starting to actually talk to each other. Tensions were melting somewhat, and we had, of course, had detente. And that's how we got a lot of the SALT treaties and things like that. And they play into that where we see American, British, and Soviet forces fighting together once they're freed out of the prison that Strasbourg is keeping them in. One of the things, and this ties into the last movie, and it also ties in kind of to this one. One of the things that is maddening about the Bondverse is the rights situation, which we are going to get into big time here in, I think, two episodes. And you know what I'm talking about.
We're going to be talking about some stuff.
Yeah. But
all throughout.
The reason I didn't get to watch this film again today was because I went and some Bond films are on Max, some Bond films are on Prime, some Bond films are only available to be rented through various things. Because there's so many different rights issues with who owns digital rights and who owns these rights and who owns those rights. So the last film, Man with Golden Gun, that's the reason why I didn't get to see it today, because it wasn't up on a streaming service. It is, but I would have had to rent it and I didn't have time for it and wanted to make sure I got to the one I really liked.
Well, what also pisses me off is Amazon could put any of them that are not currently on a service.
Yeah.
Amazon could put them on their damn service if they wanted to. They own the fucking thing.
They own the whole thing. But so that the rights thing, Strasbourg was originally written as Stavros Blofeld. And then, of course, they had to change it because they don't own the rights to Stavros Blofeld, which, you know, again, we'll get into later.
Yeah, Blofeld, Spectre, and all that stuff at this point in time, finally, the courts ruled in favor of Kevin McClory, the guy that caused some shit with Thunderball a few episodes back.
Right.
He owned that. And we're definitely going to get to those soon.
Yes.
Especially with how Cubby Broccoli deals with all that.
For sure. But as far as this film goes, 10 out of 10, submarines trapped in a tanker. I love this fucking movie.
You mentioned, some of the facts that I was going to mention and the big one being that the jet ski and all that stuff, because they always love to introduce things that were prototypical or new at the time as something new gadget for Bond to use. So what I'm gonna do is my stunt of the movie is very easy. It's very in the beginning. It's Rick Sylvester's jump off the mountain.
Unbelievable.
Skis off the mountain, undoes the skis, unleashes a parachute. And of course, the parachute is the Union Jack, yes, which got a huge round of applause in theaters at the time. So they set up multiple cameras. This is how it was made even more impressive.
Mm-hmm.
They set up multiple cameras for this stunt. And when he skied off, almost all of them lost him.
Yeah.
And they could only do this stunt once. It took forever to get to it because of weather conditions, wind, all of that stuff. It got to the point where Broccoli was thinking Sylvester was having cold feet and said, "Hey, do you not want to do the stunt?" And Sylvester said, "Cubby, I'm just waiting for the weather to clear up."
Right.
So he finally does a stunt. All these cameras lose him except for one camera, and it follows him all the way down, and it's a perfect fucking shot.
Yep.
And it made for the greatest stunt. That's why, again, people don't understand why I love older films with big, huge, fantastical stunts. Same reason you're loving Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible films today. They're fucking doing the stunt. It's not a computer. It's not something generated.
Like, ain't no bullshit.
Like we'll get to with a certain fucking Bond film later. Yeah. But anywho, I'll get to that later. Absolutely a fantastic film. I will say, though.
You know, he almost died, right?
What's that?
On the jump.
Yes.
Yeah, the ski flew off and it actually hit the parachute as it was deploying, and could have very easily made that parachute not deploy. And so, yeah, it was. There were some hairy moments there with that scene, but great scene. God damn, that scene's so good.
I will say with the next film, which I'm not going to name just yet, although if you're watching that, if you know the series, you'll know the next film, but And You Only Live Twice, we're going to notice some themes with Gilbert's films that kind of run through, but we will get to that.
Oh, real quick.
Later.
There is one thing about the scene, with the opening scene with him skiing down the mountain and then jumping off the cliff. And this is not a fault of anybody except for this is just how filming was done in the 70s. They have to have, which it didn't need it, this whole scene didn't need it, but they have to have these establishing shots of Roger Moore looking around, looking back and stuff like that, so that you know it is him, you know, it is Bond. Yeah, it's Bond. And so you flash to these scenes with these side shots of him looking around, looking back behind him, and it's obviously in front of a screen that they're just running mountains behind him. And that was something that was done, that was just filmmaking in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Today it would not be done. They would just film the damn thing and show the actual stunt.
You will notice a lot of rear projection use.
Especially
these more Bond movies.
Yeah. Which with driving back in the day understood that. That's one of the ways they had to shoot driving scenes. Nowadays, of course, they put cars up on fucking trailers and tow them and have them actually on location. It's crazy shit. But anyway, that is the only problem with that scene that I have, and it doesn't kill it for me, but it is just one of those things where I look at it and go, oh, come on, man. You got this great stunt happening, and you're going to intersperse that shit into it. Come on.
You're just going to have to get used to it. I didn't bring it up because you're just going to have to get used to that shit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's just part of the, well, like, again, that's part of 60s, 70s, 80s filmmaking. You know, this is the way it happened.
Well, they didn't have green screens where they could digitally create the background. Right. It's like this stock footage of, like, is it a mountain skiing? Let's use that.
Yeah.
I love the movie, though. It is one of my favorites of the Roger Moore films. It's not quite my favorite. It used to be, but I have another one that's my favorite. It's actually one of his later movies, but... I think we're ready for me to rank the Bond films.
I think we're ready.
And then we're going to have a little bit of a special segment before I get to Beyond Bond.
Yeah, and I also have something I want to talk about, too. Related, but not related.
But the Bond rankings for this one now, as they stand, we have 10 films ranked now. Still at number 10 is Diamonds Are Forever. Number 9 is You Only Live Twice, Gilbert's first movie. Number 8, coming in its debut, The Man with the Golden Gun.
Mm-hmm.
Number 7 is Dr. No. Number 6 is On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Number 5 is Thunderball. Number 4 is Live and Let Die. Coming in at number 3 for its debut, The Spy Who Loved Me, which means that number 2 is still From Russia with Love, and of course number 1 is still Goldfinger.
Yes.
So the next segment I want to talk about, Jason, is that the Oscars was this past Sunday.
Yes.
What did you think? I hadn't talked to you about it.
First of all, these past 2 years, I have been so happy with the results. All the people who won. They're very deserving people. They've gotten back to not just putting up a film and winning it because it's the indie darling of the year. We've actually got to where, yes, the truly good films are making it. However, I will say this. This year, I was so impressed with the actual production of the show. The way the awards were presented, where they were doing two at a time for presenters. It moved smoothly. It started an hour earlier. The musical numbers were great. They did wonderful on those. Come to find out, Dylan told me about this. I forget his name, but I guess the director of it this year was a guy they hired because he had done the VMAs. He had done, a couple of other award shows, the BAFTAs. He had done the BAFTAs. And so I think putting it in the hands of someone who knows the foibles of award shows instead of saying, okay, which filmmaker are we going to get to direct it this year, was a smart idea because it is a different type of show. It's a different type of production. And right. This guy knows his shit. So, and it worked. Man, it was good.
Performance highlights for me. There's mm-hmm. two of them. Costume presenter John Cena.
Yes, that was fantastic. That was so funny.
Making reference of a streaker that happened in one of the previous episodes.
Yes, back in the 70s.
The male body is a delicate thing. I know, get out here. And he's got that oversized costume design.
Right.
Of course, for the audience does not know what the hell I'm talking about, John Cena apparently came out, quote unquote, naked to present the award. And then Barbie may not have won much that night. And What Was I Made For may have won Best Original Song. But Ryan Gosling won the hearts of many with his performance of I'm Just Ken.
Oh, yeah.
That was
100%.
Very well done. And he earned my undying respect when he walked down to the stage, sung along with Margot Robbie, Greta Gerwig, and America Ferrera, and blew them a kiss. Basically to say to the Oscars, I'm acknowledging the people you snubbed this year. It just kind of squashed the quote-unquote controversy of this year's show, which was that they were snubbed.
Well,
and then he has a little brief moment where he sings with Emma Stone, nice little La La Land reunion.
Yeah. Now, it was a snub somewhat, yes. But I've seen this movie, and I love the themes of this movie. And I'll be honest with you, JT. If it hadn't have been for the fact that this movie came out in a year that had great fucking filmmaking, this year was amazing as far as what films did come out. I think this thing could have won a shit ton of Oscars in any other year because it is a great movie. For those of y'all who haven't seen Barbie, this is not just a fucking movie about toys. It is a fucking good movie with a great plot.
My problem is you could have taken every award you gave to Killers of the Flower Moon, and you could have given it to Barbie.
Yeah, I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, but I know you did not. You were not impressed.
It is long. It is overrated. It focuses on the wrong things in four mm-hmm. fucking hours.
Yeah.
Lily Gladstone is only in the movie for 57 minutes. And she does give a good performance. But the highlight of her performance is every time she's on screen, she's sicker and sicker.
Yeah.
Emma Stone has a fucking arc in Poor Things. And Poor Things is a phenomenal fucking movie. Yeah. And I was so happy when Emma Stone won because I was really afraid Lily Gladstone was going to win.
Yeah. And
and
the odds
I,
on
don't get me wrong,
the Vegas odds
great.
Were
I hope
Emma.
She gets to, don't get me wrong. Gladstone's great. And I'm hoping she comes back with something that maybe she has a little bit more meat with. But that movie is. Here's my problem is I feel that Martin Scorsese, especially over his past two films, The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon, he is too critic proof. Critics do not want to say a bad thing about him because he is their Lord and Savior, Martin Scorsese. And I'm sorry, he's on my Mount Rushmore of directors. The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon blows.
They were misses.
I was so bored with Killers of the Flower Moon. But
And I'll tell you,
anywho,
the only thing that saved The Irishman for me was the fact that I knew the story. I had read the book. I knew the story of this guy that he was following in it. And it was cool to see some visualizations of, that life. But other than that, yes, you are exactly right. If it had been a standalone, not based on a true story thing, it wouldn't be as good as I think it is.
I will say this, running through just a few more things with the Oscars. So glad Robert Downey Jr. finally got his very,
Yes.
very well-deserved
Fantastic.
award. However, I'm gonna give a special honorary mention shout out to, because I just watched it last night, Sterling K. Brown for American Fiction. We watched American Fiction last night.
I'm watching that and Poor Things tomorrow, so I'll talk with you about it here soon.
Okay, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I feel American Fiction deserved the best adapted screenplay Oscar. I'll explain that. Well, we'll talk about that later. I'm not going to get in details because you haven't watched it. But Jeffrey Wright, Sterling K. Brown, everyone in the movie did great performances, but they stand out. They make the movie worth watching it alone. The comedy is worth watching it. The drama is just a little uneven, and the tone of the movie sometimes I'm kind of like, what am I supposed to be feeling here? But anyway, let me think. What else? Well, yeah, Poor Things. Poor Thing. I mean, nothing could stand up to Oppenheimer, but Poor Things had four wins, and Oppenheimer had seven. And then I think it was Anatomy of a Fall that had two. Those were the only films that won multiple awards. So it was definitely Oppenheimer's night. Christopher Nolan got one of what should have been five or six Best Director awards by now. But anyway, we won't get
But
into
he
that.
finally got it. That's the
He
important thing.
fucking
He got it.
finally got it. He fucking got it, and I was so happy. Yeah, great award ceremony. In fact, the reason I wanted to bring up the Academy Awards before Beyond Bond, I'm kind of tying it in there.
Before you do, I want to mention one thing. Folks,
You okay, go ahead.
no. I'm going to do my thing, my other thing after you do Beyond Bond, but this is about the Oscars. Real quick, folks. And I'm laughing about this because I do understand the moaning, the bitching, moaning and complaining about this because it is true. It was an awkward moment. Al Pacino, the man is 800 years old. And yes, he's an icon. Let's please stop trotting him out in these award shows and then wondering why it all went wrong. I agree with
But
you.
the
It was an
problem,
awkward moment. My I see Oppenheimer. And yeah, I get
is
it.
right before. But the problem is it's been revealed right before he went out there. The producers told him not to tell the nominees again. They came up to him and said, "Hey, we've been telling people who the nominees are throughout the night. So you're just going to go out there, and the Oscar goes to boom, whoever." They kind of tell him this behind the scenes. He's fully expecting to read the nominees. It's a last minute change. And so, yeah, he goes out there. He's like, "Oppenheimer."
That's what I see. I don't know. It was
It's
it.
not entirely
I love
simple,
that
but
man, and I understand the heat he's kind of getting from it. But now we know the behind the scenes. We also know that dude's old as fuck, man, and he has a newborn kid. He's like not exactly in the best of situations for here.
and also, ignore all the other quote-unquote controversial shit you see out there. Yeah. Robert Downey Jr. was coming under some flack because Ke-Hee Kwan gave him his Oscar, and he just kind of, it looked like he kind of just nonchalantly took it and walked right past him without acknowledging him. But there's behind the scenes photos where they're hugging.
You
they're
see it, yeah.
Hanging out.
Well, that
Downey Jr. was like any other person who just won the Oscars. He probably couldn't fucking believe he won an Oscar.
And please,
he was flustered.
And please, let's back off of Jimmy fucking Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel did a great fucking job as host.
Wait,
and yes,
what
he
the
made
fuck
a he made a couple of jokes that were insensitive about Robert Downey Jr.'s drug use. Robert Downey Jr. was going along with those jokes, number one. They weren't that off color about it. And I'll have them realize that he also joked about it in his acceptance speech. Kimmel did a wonderful job hosting this Oscars. So, yeah, some people just want to be angry about something. And they have to nitpick everything.
And I tell you what, though, we're going to end this on a happy note. I did like seeing Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito come out there, and they're like, of course, you know what we're known for. We were both killed by
people. Right. One of the highlights of the night for me and Dylan, we're laughing our asses off about it, is when Arnold Schwarzenegger looks out at fucking Michael Keaton and says, "You son of a bitch, you know, how dare you be here?"
And then Michael Keaton, understanding the assignment, and just looking up there like Batman and just, come on.
100%. 100%.
God, if only George Clooney had been there that night so Arnold Schwarzenegger could be like, there was my Batman.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, Danny, there's two of them.
It's a multiverse.
Yes. Oh, but, shit. But yeah, so I know now the Oscars go into your Beyond Bond. What are we doing here?
Okay, it's the Wednesday after. Let's acknowledge the big picture winner, Oppenheimer. I've chosen director Christopher Nolan's fantastic, and as of this recording, still highly underrated, Tenet.
Yeah.
The movie stars John David Washington as the protagonist. The protagonist is trying to track down a device that can invert time on objects, things, and even people. This means that while we're all moving forward in time, there are materials that are moving backwards in time. There's also a dastardly plot by the future to try and change the past along the way. The movie contains plenty of fantastic action set pieces, but the most important thing is that it has great chemistry between Washington and Robert Pattinson as a contact with a deeper connection to our protagonist than he initially lets on. In fact, after rewatching this movie recently for the sake of this episode, I realized that Pattinson, and if he were British, Washington could make strong candidates for the next people to play Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll readily admit this movie's time travel elements and certain plot points are not crystal clear, and that is by design. Nolan likes for his audiences to have to think a little bit with his movies, and that is never more apparent than it is with this movie.
Yeah, which I think is why it gets a lot of flack.
I think so. So if you're going into this movie expecting full answers, you may be a bit disappointed. However, I think if you have you'll have a fun time if you just manage to let yourself go and be embraced by the movie and what it has to offer. It's a really, really excellent movie. So Tenet's my recommendation this week. Jason, do you have a tie-in this week?
I do have a tie-in. I have a fun little story, side story for you folks. So, Jay, in our family, we have these things we tend to hyper-focus on. JT tends to be movies. My son tends to be video games. My thing tends to be music. And so, a little side story here. In The Spy Who Loved Me, of course, we already mentioned Carly Simon is the one who sings the theme song Nobody Does It Better. And if you haven't ever taken a little dive into Carly Simon, go find her. Go listen to her music. She is amazing. But one of the funny things about her is, a funny little side story is that she wrote a song called You're So Vain. And for years, she has kept it secret. You know, what, 40, 50 years now, she kept it secret as to who You're So Vain was about. A lot of people just assume it's James Taylor, who she dated for a very long time. She has said it is not James Taylor. There is a gentleman that paid her to come play at his private birthday party, and he paid X amount of $1 million or so to get the answer. She would officially give him the answer. He signed a non-disclosure agreement before she would give the answer. So there is at least one person who knows. However, relating it back to the movie world, the shithouse rumor and the thing that's not totally confirmed, but almost everyone believes, You're So Vain was written about Warren Beatty. And if you listen to the song as she describes the person she's talking about, you're like, oh yeah, that's Warren Beatty.
Let's face facts here. Yeah. That does not surprise me at all.
No, not at all. Warren Beatty, known as the guy who slept with every woman he ever met. Yes.
I mean, let's face facts. This was the guy that when he finally he settled down and married Annette Bening.
Yeah.
Everyone said that marriage would be over.
Oh, yeah, it's
like
doomed.
A week.
Yeah.
And yet it did last. So he must have sowed his wild oats or whatever. But yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
But like, yeah, just a fun little side fact about the lady who performed probably one of my favorite Bond songs. I love Nobody Does It Better. I love Live and Let Die. And, of course, I love the theme to Goldfinger. Those are all just great. All right. So what are we doing now, JT? Are we going to get off this thing and go bullshit about other movie news now and let people wonder what else we talk about?
I tell you what, for anybody out there maybe looking for some discussion about a little bit of horror news,
yes,
I will go ahead and bring this up in relation to what this show normally is, Horror Bros. So, Jason, I said, you know, I took firm stance when Michelle Barrera was fired from Scream 7.
Right.
I'm just not going to watch it.
Fuck it. I'm tired of this. I ain't
no reason to watch it. It was unfair, and it was.
Yes.
They announced that Neve Campbell is coming back with Kevin Williamson directing Scream 7.
Yeah, we're back.
I'm left wondering, where are my morals?
Yeah.
Where's my hardcore stance? And then I think, it's just a fucking movie. I'm going to go watch it now.
Yeah.
Although I would love to see the size of the giant fucking dump truck of money that they just pulled into Neve Campbell's backyard.
Right.
And went, we fucked up.
Yeah.
Please.
It has to be humongous because she was done. She wasn't coming back.
And it was overpay. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me see something here. This is related back to the Oscars, and then we'll wrap this thing up. My roommate texted me while we were talking, and he said to me, going forward, and I'll have to explain this visual joke to the audiences, but I'm going to show it to you on the camera first here, Jason, to see if you can see it. Going forward, they should make the Oscar award look like this. I don't know how well that's
going to look. Oh, nice. Yes, it's John Cena naked with a envelope in front of his junk. Yes.
And what was hilarious about that is I think that Jimmy Kimmel referenced it the next night, and he pulled out the actual card he had to hold in front,
mm-hmm.
and it was like huge because they had to be obviously bigger than the regular card, because John Cena's a monster.
He's a gigantic goddamn human. Things grow in proportion, folks. Come on, you know.
But anywho, I think that would be hilarious. I think that'd be a good humorous Oscar to give out at least.
Especially
once a
if
year.
They did it just for the costume design. The award he gave out with that would be hilarious. A naked John Cena is.
I don't want to snub someone.
Yes.
Or in this case, a group of people. I can't remember their names right off the bat, but I was so happy to see Godzilla Minus One win Best Visual Effects.
100%. And I have not seen this movie yet, but I know the story behind the special effects. Wasn't it only $50 million? And they made this movie look like it was a $200 million production.
These guys made a $15 million movie look like $200 million. They showed Hollywood, you do not have to spend $300 million to make a blockbuster-looking movie. And in fact, I like that one guy that got on stage and said, you're taking a risk on $200 million. Why not take a risk on $10 million movies? And he's absolutely fucking right.
100%.
That's how we got the indies film wave in the 90s. That's how we get good movies.
You and I have been saying for years now that Blumhouse and 824 and all them are showing Hollywood how to sustain themselves with micro-budgeted films. Which it kills me that $10 million is considered a micro-budget now. You know, it's that's a lot of fucking money, folks. You know, but yeah, you know, is the micro budgeted film is going to save Hollywood. These fucking blockbusters, they're going to be able to do one or two a year, but they're going to have to fill the gap with really good movies that are not as highly budgeted.
They need to go back to the old way. Take one studio, for example. You make two, maybe three, $150 million movies.
Right.
Those are your big budget tentpole movies. Those are the ones you're going to bank on. But then, yes, you spread the wealth and you have these movies that come out in January and February and September and October that you're taking a risk on. You're going to more than likely get your money back, but you're taking a little bit of a risk to see if they're going to work out. We got to get back to that because that's what's, you know, I always use a film that I love as an example. I loved Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny last year, but I was blown the fuck away when I learned it cost $300 million to make that movie.
Right.
And because there should be no.
And I think $299 million of that was Harrison Ford's salary.
Yeah. Well, in reality, see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
To put it in perspective, he only got, in the perspective relative to that budget, only $20 million of it was his salary. And you're telling me that you had to spend $280 million to make the rest of this movie?
Yeah.
It's Indiana Jones. They're based on 1930s cheap movie serials. They don't need to be $300 million.
But the, and I'll give you an example of the way you do it right. Micro budgeted film that, you know, The Holdovers. One of my favorite movies of this past year. It is so good. And it did not cost them a fuck ton of money to make it because it's just a great story.
So that movie was so good that had the slim chance of Paul Giamatti beating Cillian Murphy for best actor, wouldn't have bothered me at all.
Right.
I personally think it was Cillian Murphy's year, and he totally earned it.
Oh, 100%.
But then all of a sudden, I'm watching The Holdovers and going, it's a race.
Yeah.
And it's a two-man race
to
best actor. Emma Stone was easily the best of the actresses. Right.
Yeah, I saw it when she had 57% odds to win in Vegas. I was like, okay, she's going to win.
However, our girl Divine Joy Randolph won for Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers.
Yes.
Very well deserved.
So well deserved. So well deserved.
The Christmas party scene in The Holdovers. I don't want to say anything for spoilers.
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough to win it there.
That's the scene.
Yeah.
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 There were a few films though that I did get to write down that I haven't seen. That's kind of why I have a love-hate relationship with the Academy. You know, sometimes the Academy can be too pretentious, but at the end of the day, I also have a list of movies that I didn't think about, I missed, or didn't even know they made over the past year, to kind of go and watch it. So I've got a nice little list. American Fiction was one that I just missed, and I made up for that yesterday.
But yeah, anyway. For me, it was Poor Things and American Fiction. Like I said, I'm going to watch those tomorrow and kind of catch up on what I didn't see. But yeah, anyway, so
I think that's it.
Yeah, it's time to roll
I think
this thing out.
we're good to wrap this up. So, as always, that's all for this episode. We hope you liked what you heard. This is the end of episode 5, Saltzman's Fall and Cubby's Comeback. But the Bond Bros will return in episode 006, 007 to the Moon.
Remember, everybody, until next time, love each other. Bye.
Later.